UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. Stay tuned. The best type of fasting in the month of Ramadan is the one in which the person who fasts separates his heart and soul from mundane world and only thinks about Allah and love for Him. Since the holy month of Ramadan is considered as the banquet of Allah, we are entering the safe realm of Allah. Therefore, we must only let the love of Allah inside our heart in this holy month.
چون قلبها نوعاً روزه نیست نگه داشتن چشم.
Usually, we are fasting in the month of Ramadan without having our heart fasting. Our eyes must be fasting in this month too. In this month, we must take more care of our eyes and do not look at undesirable things. There must be divine lesson in each look of us at the world. In this month, we must forget about illegitimate looks and also unnecessary looks around us. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The political rift between the East and the West continues to broaden day after day. That can be clearly seen in the recent comments made by Russian President Vladimir Putin. In an interview with the Russian media, President Putin accused the United States and NATO of seeking to build a new global axis. Putin said the Union bore some resemblance to the World War II alliance between Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan. The Russian president also criticized Washington for its double standards and its own action in forming several military alliances. He named Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea as being in line to join what he termed as a global NATO.
They are announcing that they will create global NATO. What's that? Great Britain and Japan at the start of this year, in January, I think, have signed an agreement on developing relations and mutual development in military area.
The remarks by Putin come days after he and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping met in Moscow to discuss global developments. That created the idea for many in the Western world that the two powers are seeking to form a military alliance.
It does not correspond with reality at all. We are not creating any military alliance with China. Yes, we have cooperation in this sphere of military technical interaction. We are not hiding this. Everything is transparent. There is nothing secret. We have military cooperation. We conduct drills not only with China, but even with other countries as well.
In a statement following their Moscow summit, the two leaders said their relations are not bloc-like, confrontational, or directed at third countries. The statement comes as Washington has recently said that it fears Beijing could arm Russia in its war with Ukraine. Moscow, however, has time and again reiterated that its stance in Ukraine is defensive in nature against the aggressive West. This is why Russia has pointed its fingers at the West for funneling billions of dollars worth of ammunition to Ukraine. Moscow argues that the help from the Western alliance to Kiev does pose a threat to its national security. Putin, however, has assured that Russia will not be outgunned in the war despite all the Western interference. Putin's remarks come at a time when China and Russia already share a common concern of encirclement by the United States and NATO. Many say Russia sees NATO's eastward expansion as an existential threat, which, according to them, has been the main reason for its war with Ukraine. In West Asia, the United States maintains its presence in countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But the reality on the ground indicates that Washington is only after plundering their natural riches. Washington's presence in the West Asia region also serves as a goal to maintain its encirclement of Russia. In East Asia, China is concerned that the United States is trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From its military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan, it seems that Putin's assessment about Western powers recruiting allies from across the world to create an axis is closer to the reality. That can be significantly highlighted after NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg paid a visit to Japan and South Korea, where he stressed the Atlantic Alliance working closely with partners in the Indo-Pacific region. He also urged the nations to support Ukraine with more military support. Quite contrary, China has recently helped broker a diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia after a seven-year break and announced its decision to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. This not only shows there is no West-like military alliance between Washington and Beijing, but also indicates that countries in the East are seeking a peaceful resolution to the world's crises unless their national security is threatened. From a different perspective, an alliance between America's two greatest strategic and military foes would not be as bad, given that there is high potentiality to shift the global order.
March 26th marks the 8th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen, a conflict which started after Riyadh, leading a coalition of 9 countries from West Asia and North Africa, launched an intervention to reinstate Saudi-backed former president Abdrabu Mansour Hadi after he was ousted by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. According to UN figures, the war has so far claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people and brought the country's vital infrastructure to the brink of collapse. The war has also displaced millions of people. Riyadh and its allies also imposed a crippling blockade on Yemen, which has consequently caused a dire humanitarian crisis, with millions of children suffering from malnutrition and diseases like cholera. In a recent report, the United Nations expressed concern that it could be forced to slash support for children in Yemen without a funding boost. The UN Children's Agency said more than 540,000 under the age of 5 are suffering life-threatening severe acute malnutrition, with one child continuing to die every 10 minutes from preventable causes. UNICEF said if funding is not received, the agency might be forced to scale down its vital assistance, adding that the children of Yemen should be able to look to the future with hope, not fear. Peter Hawkings, UNICEF's representative in Yemen, said, "We called on all parties to help us deliver that hope by committing to the Yemeni people and pulling a country and a weary population back from the brink." But given all the sufferings by the Yemeni people, the war has stopped well shy of all its goals, despite killing hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turning Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Not only the war has not stopped, but the West's all-out support for Saudi Arabia has even exacerbated the situation and diminished prospects for peace. While Saudi Arabia maintains its blockade on Yemen, the humanitarian situation there is deteriorating day after day. This comes in light of the silence of the international community in dealing with the human catastrophe there. The current situation in Yemen questions the role of world countries in bringing the years-long deadly conflict to an end. Some countries have made efforts to help decrease the sufferings of the Yemeni people by sending humanitarian aid to the war-torn country or facilitate intra-Yemen talks to end the conflict. However, a sustainable political settlement in Yemen requires a more comprehensive approach. With the United Nations working with Yemeni parties and also regional and international stakeholders, there are hopes that the devastating conflict could soon be over. As long as a ceasefire is concerned, although a truce agreed between warring sides in April 2022 has largely been held, the UN Secretary-General's Special Envoy for Yemen says the military situation in Yemen is fragile. Hans Grundberg says the truce can only be a stepping stone, adding that the UN urgently needs to build on what was achieved by the truce and work towards a nationwide ceasefire and an inclusive political settlement to end the conflict in Yemen. Grundberg says, now that Iran and Saudi Arabia have finally clinched an agreement to restore diplomatic relations and reopen embassies and missions, the warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take the decisive steps towards peace. He says momentum to end the conflict in Yemen has been renewed by a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume ties. This can be clearly highlighted in comments made by Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who has numerously reaffirmed Tehran's support for any dialogue which would help promote peace and stability in Yemen. The top diplomat says the Islamic Republic supports intra-Yemeni talks to find a political solution to the crisis in the war-wracked Arab country. Even former Saudi officials have expressed optimism that the agreement between Tehran and Riyadh will be a game-changer for West Asia. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is that ending the years-long Yemen conflict requires patience, long-term perspective, courage, and leadership. According to the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, much has been achieved over the past year, and now it is time to take the next step.
France is in a crisis mode. Police have clashed with protesters angry at President Macron's controversial pension reforms. Unions claim 3.5 million people turned out across the country, while authorities suggested the figure was much lower at just under 1.1 million. In the capital, Paris, union leaders said that a record 800,000 people took part in the march throughout the city to demand that the government drop the fiercely contested change. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said dozens of police officers had been injured and dozens of people were arrested across the country. Earlier, workers blocked access to a terminal at the Charles de Gaulle Airport, forcing some travelers to get there on foot. French trade unions have called for fresh nationwide strikes and protests amid growing anger over the government's unpopular pension reforms. Trade unions have blamed the government for, quote, the explosive situation in the country. They also asked workers to continue protesting against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms.
For us, 10, 12 years ago, the previous pension reform was already unacceptable. What we want is a retirement age at 60 years old and 55 years old for those with hard-working conditions. And at one point, all these demands have to be expressed on the ground. And if we have to go beyond the demands set by the inter-unions, then this is what we will do.
Train and air travel was disrupted, while teachers were among many professions to walk off the job. Plumes of smoke were seen rising from burning piles of debris, blocking traffic on a highway near Toulouse in southwestern France. And strikes briefly blocked roads in other cities as well. Police also fired tear gas at some protesters in several other cities and used water cannon against others in Rennes in the northwest. Protests against the measures have raged since January.
The only thing he could say to appease the anger would be that he renounces reform, that there won't be any reform, that he respects the fact that the vast majority of the people don't want it, and that he regrets the way it happened. It most probably won't be that way, so I think we are in a deep crisis that will linger on for weeks and maybe months.
The But French President Emmanuel Macron has said the legislation, which his government pushed through the French parliament without a vote last week, would come into force by year-end, despite escalating tensions. The protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago.
We may be at the beginning of a new Gilets Jaunes, Yellow Vest movement, absolutely, because there is no democratic way out. The only thing that could avoid that would be a decision by the Supreme Court, the French Supreme Court, to overrule the law and to, you know, reset the legislative process. It has the power to do this. This is the only hope we have to avoid a major crisis.
Opinion polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote. Since December, Macron has suffered a substantial drop of 8 points, and he now sees only 28% satisfied and 70% dissatisfied. Macron's government has shunned parliament to impose the unpopular pension reforms via a special constitutional power, the so-called Article 49.3, which provides that the government can pass a bill without a vote at the National Assembly, the lower house of parliament, after a deliberation at a cabinet meeting.
I think this was a denial of democracy. The government passed a law for which a majority of French people were against. The National Assembly was against it, using the 49.3 as a scornful of French public opinion. Macron was elected with no majority. He was elected against the Front National. We did not give him a mandate to pass these reforms, which are unjust.
Procedure has been used in the past by various governments, but this time, it's prompting a lot of criticism because of the massive public opposition to the proposed reform. The proposed changes include raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increasing the number of years people must make contributions to receive a full state pension. The reforms were at the heart of President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. The government insists the reform plan is essential to ensure the French pension system does not run out of money.
So yes, there aren't 100 solutions if we want the pension system to be balanced. It no longer is. And the more we wait, the more it will get worse. And so this reform is necessary. And I say this to the French people, I don't enjoy doing this, I would have preferred not to do this, but it's also because of a sense of responsibility that I express my commitment to do this in front of you.
But many see the changes, such as raising the retirement age, as unfair to people who started working young.
I'm already disadvantaged in terms of my quarterly periods, given my redundancy, given the retirement age, which is being pushed back again and again. I've had a very, very long career. I started at 15, and I feel like I'll never get there.
Last September, three explosions targeted the Nord Stream 1 and 2 natural gas pipelines. The blast rendered three of the four lines inoperable and released vast quantities of methane into the Baltic Sea. None of the four pipes are currently operational, bringing the Nord Stream project to an effective standstill. Back then, there were speculations the U.S. may have carried out the sabotage attack. Back then, former Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski thanked the U.S. for damaging the Nord Stream gas pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again. Then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly? Since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control.
We will. I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
But in February 2023. U.S. investigative journalist Seymour Hersh alleged that the blasts were carried out by the U.S. in a top-secret CIA operation ordered by President Joe Biden, with the collaboration from Norway. Hersh claimed that the U.S. Navy divers operating from a Norwegian ship, using NATO's exercise in June 2022 as cover, had planted mines which were later remotely detonated by a sonar bio dropped from a Norwegian plane.
They set up a committee to think of options. Russia was clearly going to go. The threat the president had yet to make had not been made. And this is December before New Year's Day of the year before, 2021. And The question inside the committee, and it included the usual CIA, NSA, Treasury Department, State Department, you name it. And they met in the secret office building in the across the street from the White House, the executive office building. The option was, do you want us to do something kinetic? Or something not kinetic. In other words, not kinetic would be more sanctions, or something kinetic would be, you know, taking out the pipeline, as had been thought about.
Following Hearst's revelation, news emerged in several media outlets, including the New York Times and the German newspaper Der Zeit, that pro-Ukrainian group carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines last year. But Hearst now says the CIA was instructed to come up with a cover story for the Nord Stream bombings that was fed to media outlets. Hearst says the cover-up story was created to shift blame from the U.S. Hearst says the CIA was ordered to come up with a cover story after President Biden met with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Washington on March 3.
Seymour Hersh, journalist who has been covering this extensively, says this is exactly what happened, that indeed the CIA and German intelligence created this whole hogwash cover story and handed it to the media, double-spaced, you know, just exactly what they wanted you to ingest, and that the media ran with it.
Over a year has passed since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Since the war began, the U.S. and its Western allies rushed to Ukraine's help and armed it with various types of weapons. They are now inextricably involved in the outcome of the war. In 2022, the U.S. led the way with major support decisions for Ukraine, with EU countries following suit. According to the Institute for the World Economy, adding pledges of nearly 37 billion euros in December, the Americans have earmarked a total of just over 73.1 billion euros for Ukraine's support. For the EU, the comparable figure is 54.9 billion euros. Based on estimates, the ammunition sought by Kiev could cost the bloc some 825 million euros for just 1 month. There are talks of the delivery of depleted uranium to Ukraine. Russia has already warned against such escalations. A report by the World Bank said that it will cost Ukraine $411 billion over the next 10 years to recover and rebuild from the war. Apart from Ukraine, Europe has also been forced to foot the bill. The economy of Europe is also suffering immensely. The European Union's industry chief has said the bloc will have to shift to a wartime economic model if it hopes to meet Kiev's battlefield needs. Europe's heavyweights like Germany are suffering economically. The war and the growing energy prices have cost the German economy about 2.5% of its GDP.
Faced with new and overlapping shocks, we have no choice today but to deal with uncertainty. But the public can be certain about one thing. We will deliver price stability, and bringing inflation back to 2% over the medium term is not negotiable.
While the impact is milder than expected, the country still faces a minor recession. The Biden administration is luring European companies, including German businesses. According to the German-American Chamber of Commerce, around 5,600 of them have invested in the U.S. market as of September 2022. That's an investment volume of almost $650 billion. So the question is, why is Europe risking its economic independence for the benefit of the United States and its businesses?
This was a premeditated terrorist attack on European critical infrastructure. It was also environmental terrorism. Does the EU care? Do you need to know who did it, or do you want to know? Hearst says the US did it. Did you ask him? Did you ask him, did they do it? Or do you ask them questions anymore? Have we become so subservient? Has the EU become so subservient to US empire that you can't even ask them if they did it?
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the 8th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers, and like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the beautiful dialogues, these golden conversations, if you will, of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, when we are talking about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, we find that he had very many conversations and dialogues with his friends, his companions, his relatives, and with the people in general. Now, of course, being this pivot and this axis of socio-religious and political affairs, we find that a very great many and beautiful traditions via these conversations have come to us in the present day. Now, we find that sometimes in our lives, we tend to pin our hopes, our dreams, our aspirations, or the end result of something in other people. So we rely on other people, we put our hopes in other people. Now, in and of itself, there isn't a problem with relying on other people, or perhaps seeking help from other people. Of course, one of the things that has been commanded to us by the Almighty Allah is to help one another, to help the other Muslim brothers and sisters, and of course to help humanity on the whole. Now, of course, this assistance and this reliance then is something that is integral in Islam. But we must remember that the end all means and the true source of all of these things, and the only way to be able to achieve success, prosperity, and victory, of course, is in the hands of the Almighty Allah. And so we must never pin our absolute hope, and we must never pin our absolute reliance and our needs with somebody other than the Almighty Allah. First and foremost, we must know that the original cause, the only cause, the primary cause, and the pure source of all of our aspirations and hopes and needs is the Almighty Allah. Exalted and mighty is He. Now, once we have this in mind, then of course we can go and seek help from other people when we need it. This idea that we are not independent, and rather understanding this idea that we are dependent upon the Almighty Allah. And so along these lines in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to his companion that whoever hopes in a dissolute, the least of their punishment is that they will be deprived of that said blessing, and of course their needs will not be satisfied. And so of course a human being must not have this ultimate hope in anyone except the Creator and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Almighty, the Wise, the Knowledgeable, the Most Powerful. Now there are two ways at least to interpret this second part, which is that an individual will be deprived of the blessings and their needs will not be satisfied. Now one interpretation is that Allah Himself will deprive that individual of blessings, and Allah Himself will not satisfy the needs and the requests of the individual. Of course, because that individual has not asked Allah for the blessings and they have not asked Allah to fulfill their needs, so technically, why would Allah want to do so? But another interpretation is that, well, you will be deprived of the blessings because you are asking one who does not have the power to give you those blessings. And on the other hand, your needs will not be satisfied, your needs and requests will not be fulfilled, of course, because you are asking one who, again, does not have the power to satisfy those needs, does not have the power to fulfill those needs and those requests. And so thus you are in this manner also deprived of blessings, and you are also not able to fulfill the needs and desires that you had been requesting. But of course, in our daily lives, if we rely on the Almighty Allah, if we rely on the most merciful, the most compassionate Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then not only will Allah endow us with the blessings that are appropriate, but He will also fulfill those needs and requests, again, that are appropriate for every single one of us. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alaykum أيها النور الصافي السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالع
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the Righteous, the Pious, the Faithful Leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Decides to, you know, migrate and to go in a place that there is no one but him to, you know, be helpful for the muhibbin of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam. This is really important.
When we refer to his biography, we see one of his great achievement is establishment of the open school in the West.
Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from al-mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say?
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Ya mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, ulama, and jurists all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about a personality, a Shiite one, who has spent most of his life in the U.S., you know, and continuing his Islamic studies and training the students, the Muslim Shia ones, over there. He is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Husseini Jalali, also the founder of the Open School in Chicago. Really, a fruitful life he had over there, and is considered among the most outstanding bibliographer and codicologist of the 14th century Hijra all across the world of Islam. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the life of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, he was born in 1362 lunar calendar in Karbala, and he started his house studying in his childhood, and actually he benefited from the outstanding maraji of his time, Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim, Sayyid Abul Ghassim al-Khoi, Mirza Hassan Bujnuli. And he was really talented in his studying to the extent that he was able to get permission of rivaya, which is actually known of ijazah rivayat.
That's right.
This is not the position to be given easily to the students mm-hmm. of the ulama.
Yes.
When they reach to a level mm-hmm. of their scholarly life, they are given this position or this permission.
This ijazah is different from ijazah of ijtihad, you mean?
Yes, definitely.
This is, it means they have the understanding or the power of recognition of which ahadith are authentic and which are not. This is the ijazah of rivaya, or what is it?
Yes, this is exactly
what you said with more information, but I think if we mention one of the great ulama who gave him the permission of ijaza, it may create a clear picture for our audiences yes. and our listeners. What do we mean by ijaza riwaya? Among the ulama from which he got the permission of riwaya is Agha Buzurg Tehrani. Mm-hmm. Agha Buzurg Tehrani, he himself is considered as one of the great ulama who is really expert in terms of codicology
yes.
and bibliography.
That's right.
Al-Dhari'a fi Tasanif al-Shi'a is yes. his work. That is yeah. a perfect work.
Yeah.
In terms of compiling the works of Shia.
That's right, the magnum opus of Sheikh Al-Bazir.
Yes, definitely. So he actually got permission of ijaza riwaya from Agha Buzurg Tehrani.
That's right.
In a sense that he was really familiar with the context of the riwayat
That's
to
right.
distinguish between okay. the authenticated riwayat, yes. fabricated riwayat, the narrators, That's chain right. of the narrators, okay. books in yes. which riwayat are compiled,
yes.
and things in relation to the riwaya and ahadith.
So he had mastery over the important references and resources of Islam, and especially the Shia.
And
Islam.
Definitely manuscripts.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
That's right, the manuscripts. That's yes. all right. Very good. Thank you very much for these introductory remarks. So what made him move to the U.S., I mean, the Chicago brother, Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali Sheikh Zainiyah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, when he completed his studies in Najaf, you know, there was an invitation from the Shia people in Chicago,
yes.
in United States of America, and they invited him to go there and to be a resident scholar over there,
Very good.
To preach Islam and to, you know, introduce Islam, like the correct version of Islam to them.
That's right.
So he accepted this invitation and he was, you know, committed to this, you know, acceptance up to the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he was buried over there also. Yes,
that's right. In the Shiite cemetery of Chicago, he's buried yes. over there. That's right.
So it's very important that a person that is, mujtahid
yes.
and is completely, knowledgeable person.
Yes.
And he has a good future mm-hmm. in Najaf.
Yes.
If he stays in Najaf or if he stays in Qom, he will be a prominent scholar.
Scholar
he will
right.
be a prominent teacher.
Yes.
And there will be a good future for him in this, scholarly world of
that's
Qom right. or Najaf.
That's right.
But he decides to, migrate.
Yes.
And to go in a place that there is no one but him.
That's right.
To, be helpful for the Shia of
right.
Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam and for the followers and,
yes.
Muhibbin of Ahlul Bayt
yes.
alayhi salatu wassalam. This is really important.
This is really important. And, the interesting point is that the people stay over there. I mean, the Americans or the people in the Western countries stay in their own lands, and then the true preaching, of Islam and propagation all across the world could be manifested in the activities of people like Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali. I think this is very much difficult. I mean, more difficult than staying in your homeland,
for
which
sure.
is a Muslim land, and preach Islam.
For sure. For a scholar, living in Qom or Najaf is much easier
yes.
than living, for example, in a city like Chicago.
Chicago, that's
because
right.
Because here, if you have your students,
yes.
you have your, relationship with the people that are familiar with your manner.
Yes.
But when you go somewhere that people are stranger with these issues,
yes.
you need to talk to them in a way that they understand.
Yes.
So this is really hard.
Yes.
And, taking this burden is not easy at all.
No, it's not easy. No.
So we should say that late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali was really, mukhlas and sincere in this
yes,
regard to
good.
Accept such invitation and have such devotion to Islam to, take such a,
yeah.
huge burden on his shoulder.
That's
to
right.
defend Islamic
yes.
ideologies.
I think what helped the late Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali very much in the U.S. was his mastery over different resources and references, you know. Because, you know, in the Western world, especially in the academic sense of the word, really they pay very much attention to the books and the references and the resources with which you are familiar. And this was, I think, the advantage of the presence of Sayyid Muhammad Hossein Jalali in that atmosphere over there. Yeah. Because when you have mastery over different resources and the people get to you in order to find answers, you can introduce to them authentic resources and references. And this is, I think, very great.
Yes, you know, because nowadays we see that these scholars, or let me use the word that maybe scholars is somehow is referring to a person who is in high level of knowledge. Yes. There are some, you know, individuals or students in Islamic seminaries that they are invited by, you know, some Western communities to be, you know, the resident alim or resident scholar of the place.
Yes.
But the problem is that because, you know, some people are not knowledgeable enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they are in a position that they are questioned by people in many different fields.
Yes.
So this makes the situation hard to them.
Hard to them, that's right.
And that's why the figures like Ayatollah Jalali
was
successful in this field. Because, that's whenever questions are coming toward him, he knows from where this question is arose and how he should face with such question.
That's right.
But if I'm not a well-experienced person, I'm not, you know, I'm not having a good experience regarding a hadith or regarding the tafsir of Ayatul Quran. So when questions comes toward me, so I need to, you know, make some, you know, answers from my own side. And this make the situation difficult.
That's all right. Sheikh Mahdawi, that's why he established the open school over there, isn't it? I mean, the open school under the management of Sayyid Muhammad Hossein Hosseini Jalali was established in Chicago, isn't it?
Yeah, this is, when we refer to his biography, we see one of his great achievement is establishment of the open school in the West. And we know that how it is difficult to get adopted with the society to the extent that you are not only invited there, you are given this chance to establish such a cultural entity among them, and everybody is going to know that place with your name. And who is this person and what kind of personality is being carried by this person? It's a kind of traditional personality, being the student of Sayyid Abul Qasim al-Khoui, being the student of Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim, being born in Karbala.
So
how we can imagine, nowadays it is possible because of the communication that we have nowadays with abroad. Students are coming to Qom, from Qom students are moving, whether or not they are native Iranian or they are from other countries who have come to Qom to learn about Islam and then move back to their country. It is possible this day. But back to the time that Sayyid Muhammad Hossein Jalali was living, it was kind of
hardly
we would imagine that a person who had the experience of being student of Sayyid Abul Qasim al-Khoui, living the environment of Iraq, and living that traditional environment and migrating, as my brother mentioned, to U.S., and as you said, the establishment of the school.
The open school.
The establishment of a cultural entity, it shows how powerful he was in terms of his knowledge, in terms of his personality, his morality, and being commonly accepted by the people over there.
Again, the concept of tabligh comes to my mind, you know, how much this tabligh and, dissemination of the thoughts and propagation of the thoughts of the Shiite Muslims and Shiite theology is important, especially in today's world. Because, you know, sometimes the problem is this. We have so many non-Muslim scholars on Islam and the Shiite Islam who are compiling the books. Sometimes these books come to the Muslim lands, are translated, and are used by the public, okay? But the picture that is shown is not authentic at all. The case is that we have to, I think, nurture some scholars who have the capability and mastery over different resources and know different languages, and then send them to all across the world in order to preach the true Islam in the true sense of the word. Of course, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hossein Jalali himself was a faqih, was a jurist, he was an ayatollah, got ijazah from Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani. So for sure, establishing a school like the Open School in Chicago really helped very much the Shiite population over there. And there are some people who nowadays have some problems because of these, the sanctions that are done on some of the Muslim lands. So they can stay in their homelands and benefit from preachers like this person over there and the schools over there. I think this is really great. What he had done was really great. Very much sacrifice is needed. He has also some compilations, isn't it? I mean, there are some compilations. Of course, as they say, his scholar life is divided into three parts. Some of them are authoring the books, the other one on bibliography, and the other one are on the correction or editing of the books, because he was a codicologist too, and this is very important. That's all right. So this outstanding man, I mean, Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, passed away on Rabi Yosani 5th, 1442, according to the Hijra calendar. It was about 1 year and a half years ago, or 1 year ago, that's right, in Chicago, in the U.S., and he was buried in the cemetery of the Muslims of Chicago over there. May Allah bless his soul, and may Allah bless the soul and protect the true preachers of Islam who are truly sacrificing their lives and dedicate their life to the path of Islam, the Shia Islam, and Imam of the age, Imam al-Mahdi al-Jalallah. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher.
You're most welcome, madam.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was The Teacher on the life and works of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Husseini Jalali, the founder of the Open School of Chicago. May Allah bless his soul. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight.
Human rights advocates have warned French officials about the use of force against the anti-government protesters. They have warned that demonstrators and journalists were arbitrarily arrested and subjected to extreme tactics. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Euronews, hundreds of demonstrators have been taken into custody in France in the past week in response to major protests erupting all across the country against the government's pension reform. After the first spontaneous rally on March 16th, 292 people were taken into custody and presented to the public prosecutor's office to receive a caution, but only 9 protesters have been charged with actual offenses. This means that almost 97% or 283 cases were closed without any follow-up or charges being pressed. French media even reported that 2 Austrian minors on a school trip ended up in police custody following protests on March 16th. The Austrian embassy intervened to have them released. Questions are now being raised about whether this police mass arrest tactic is being used simply to frustrate the protest movement. Lawyers, magistrates, and politicians are denouncing the arbitrary police custody, seeing it, as in other protest movements in recent years, as a repression of the social movement. One of the main issues with the recent spate of protests and arrests is that police have not always been given clear reasons for the detention. Colleen Bullion, a lawyer who assisted some demonstrators, explained that protesters had all sorts of profiles: students at the local university, doctors, homeless people, minors, trade unionists, teachers,